Well, if you have your Bibles, I do invite you to grab them and turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's the book of Ecclesiastes, and we'll pick it up this morning in chapter 11. And I'm going to warn you right out of the gate, this is another chipper one. It has been a long time coming, but we will, Lord willing, take it all the way to the end of the book. As some of you know, I actually preached this passage a few years back, and so while it might sound a little bit familiar, I do think it is always a timely reminder. I just found myself, as I was working this one back up again, that my soul was being affected in some significant ways. And since we don't have a lot of time together, and it's a bit larger of a section, just by way of introduction, let's just go ahead and read the passage, and then we'll jump in. So that's Ecclesiastes chapter 11, and we'll start in verse 7. Solomon writes, "The light is pleasant, and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything that is to come will be futility. So rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes, yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all of these things. So remove grief and anger from your heart and put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near when you will say, 'I have no delight in them,' before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and clouds return after the rain, in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble and mighty men stoop, the grinding ones stand idle because they are few, and those who look through the windows grow dim, and the doors on the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low, and one will arise at the sound of the bird, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. Furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags himself along, and the caperberry is ineffective. For man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. So remember him before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is crushed. The pitcher by the well is shattered and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to the God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered and searched out and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. For the words of wise men are like goads, and the masters of these collections are like well-driven nails, for they are given by one shepherd. But beyond this, my son, be warned. For the writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. So the conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil." Well, let me quickly just sum up for you what's going on here in the beginning of this passage. If you notice, he just starts off with a couple of commands. He gives the command to rejoice in verse 9 of chapter 11, and then the command to remember in verse 1 of chapter 12. Now, there are a few more commands as you just sort of work through this passage, but all of those statements are just going to end up falling in one way or another under these two larger exhortations. Now, if you know anything about how the text of Scripture works, you also know that the main point of any passage is always bound up with the command. And so since that's the case, these two commands actually control the flow and even the structure of this entire passage. And so since that's the case, what we're going to do here is just work through these two commands before we get ourselves to his greater conclusion, which is in verses 13 and 14 of chapter 12. So with that, let's look at command number one, the command to rejoice, verse 7. He writes, "The light is pleasant, and it is good for the eyes to see the sun." Now, up until this point in the book, if you remember, Solomon's just been making reference to that which is under the sun. And so he's just been talking for nearly 11 chapters here what that reality actually means for us. And so he's just showing how everything that you and I do or everything that you and I try to pursue is not only twisted and fractured, but it's actually broken. And so he's just been showing how there's nothing in this world, whether that be pleasure or wisdom or labor or even some kind of relationship that can ultimately satisfy a heart that, as he said back in chapter 3, has had eternity placed on it by an infinite creator. And so really, he's just been describing us throughout this book as a people who are forever chasing after the wind. That you and I have these bents, we have these things, whether they be dreams or hobbies or even a sense of belonging and purpose that we're constantly chasing. But the problem, as Solomon's been showing, but even as our own experience will tell us, is that right when you think you've somehow found the answer to all that seems to be lacking, or that moment for which you reach out to grab that which you think will finally satisfy your heart, it's like chasing after the wind and catching it with a net. It's like sand between your fingers. And so he's just been saying that that's our life under the sun, that nothing actually possesses the ability to satisfy your heart. There's nothing that fulfills, nothing that gives ultimate purpose or meaning, or at the very least, any kind of lasting contentment. And so he's just spent his time here laying out the futility of what it means to live a life under the sun. And so while he's been describing all throughout this book life under the sun, notice what he actually states here in verse 7. He states, "It is good for the eyes to see the sun." Now, this subtle shift here between being under the sun and now your eyes seeing the sun is actually a statement in reference to Solomon's mind to the fullness of life. And so although we're still very much under the sun and living in an existence that's utterly defined by futility, or as we've come to know that Hebrew term, havel, Solomon's point is that there is still a fullness of life to be had. That it is, as he's been saying for several chapters now, a life that God has actually created and even designed to be enjoyed. And so his great burden here in the beginning of this final section is simply to communicate yet once again and even more explicitly that it is good for man to see and experience joy. Especially as he's been saying, when you begin to see life as nothing less than a good gift from a sovereign creator who gives to all of us life and breath and all things. And so in light of that, Solomon then just gives the command here in verse 9, to rejoice. Notice he says, "Rejoice, young man," when? In your childhood. Now we're going to get to why that's important to do early in life as opposed to later in life in just a few moments. But he says, "Rejoice in your childhood," that is, when you're in your youth. "And let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart and desires of your eyes." Now, it is important to read these statements in light of what he's been saying throughout the rest of this book. And the reason for that is because it's not some kind of equivalent to the way that we might think about some things or even say some things here in the West. And so what he's not doing here is just giving us some kind of statement that we should just sort of follow our dreams and take our risks and just do whatever it is that you can do to just sort of maximize your own personal pleasure and comfort. Rather, it's simply a statement in reference to some of those passages that we've already seen now several times in chapters 2, 3, 5, 8, and 9 about pursuing joy. But if you remember, it was always the kind of joy found not in the big achievements of life where you try to find some kind of identity or purpose, but rather in the smaller details and even monotony of life, which, as we saw for Solomon, were just those everyday experiences of life, things like food and drink and family or even love, chapter 9. But what we do is we read verses like this and then tend to make everything about completion and fulfillment, don't we? Of pursuing our own personal goals and dreams and maybe trying to find completion in the perfect spouse or some kind of identity or lasting satisfaction in our career or children. But Solomon is just trying to say the same thing that he's been saying all throughout this book. The reality of life is that God has created this world and he's created it to be enjoyed. But the point of Solomon is that as you pursue those things, just pursue them knowing that they're not ultimate, they're not final, they'll never fully satisfy or fill the void and gap of eternity on your heart. And actually, one of the best ways to protect against that kind of approach to life is actually by knowing what he says here in the last part of verse 9, which is to just never forget that God is going to bring you to judgment for all of these things. And so he just says, yet one last time, pursue this life well. That is, pursue it fully. Pursue it, as he says, with all of your might. But just remember that if you try to make anything ultimate, not only will it utterly fail to satisfy, but you're still going to be judged. And so he just says, pursue these gifts, but pursue them with a wisdom that's been shaped and formed by the reality of what you know is to come. And then he says this in verse 10. He says, so remove grief and anger, vexation from your heart, and put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life, literally blackness, it's a reference here to the color of hair in youth, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. In other words, because life is short, and that youthful energy and vigor is this fleeting reality. He just says, stop worrying, stop fretting, stop trying to control the future. It's going to be here soon enough. And instead, learn the discipline of what it means to enjoy the gifts of today. The reality for all of us is that tomorrow is just not this thing that's been promised to you. And so Solomon just says, throw off that vexation and instead rejoice in your youth. Why? For the youth of life, that is the prime of life, is that moment, and it's so incredibly small, but it's that moment for when you have the greatest capacity for joy. And so as we saw last time, before your I want to's turn into your I wish I would have, Solomon just says, learn the discipline of removing grief and anger about all that you can't control and simply enjoy the gifts that God has given you what you can. It is such a simple command of Solomon, but it is one that I think is so freeing if we would just learn to obey. And then he says in verse 1 of chapter 12, he gives the command number 2, the command to remember. And this is actually Solomon's way of just helping us to understand how it is that a wise person will actually approach this idea of rejoicing. And so he just says in chapter 11, rejoice while you have the ability and capacity to do so. But as you do that, heed also this command, verse 1, remember also your creator in the days of your youth. Now, he was intentional here in using this term creator because he's just trying to remind us yet once again that when all is said and done, you and I are nothing more than a couple of finite creatures, aren't we? That is, we have a beginning and an end. Our hours are limited. And so the reality is that you and I have only a certain amount of time, and that time is not only fleeting, but it's also incredibly fragile. Our days are numbered. And so he just says here, you creature, that is the one who's not in control, the one who doesn't know what's to come or determine all things, remember, that is, live your life with reference to your creator. When? In the days of your youth. Now, let me just say here that one of the reasons for why he's making such a big deal about youth is because the older that you become, generally speaking, the easier it is for you to acknowledge that you are most definitely not an infinite being. There's just this way in which you start to become aware of your creaturely nature. Your mind just does not work as well. Your body begins to hurt and even ache in ways that you just never knew before. But the observation of Solomon is that when you're young and when you're in the prime of life, the fact of the matter is that there's just really no reality of death in your sights. In fact, it's rare that there's ever even any kind of natural pain in your body. And so what comes with this kind of painlessness and even still flexible reality is that it's just quite easy for you to think and even make your decisions as if you are, whether you actively think about it this way or not, but as if you are the creator. as if you actually have some kind of control or are perhaps sovereign over your days. And so when you're younger, the fact that you're still resilient, it's just not all that difficult for you to just sort of passively assume that everything is just going to work out for you. And so what often comes with that kind of mindset is this reality where you just sort of push things off until you're older. And so generally, and I say generally because there are always exceptions, but generally, the older that you become and the more pain that you feel, the easier it is to acknowledge that you are a creature and begin to accept the fact that you are going to die. But even in this, Solomon says that there is a kind of futility. And the reason for that is because the older that a person becomes and the more aware that they are of their creaturely weakness, usually the more hardened and even bitter they begin to become toward God and life. They start to recognize that life just isn't what they thought it would be. It didn't actually give them all of their hopes and dreams. And now sitting at the end of life, there can be for some people this incredible amount of anger and even bitterness toward all that life wasn't. And so although now in their older age acknowledge finally, they see their creaturely status, the more prone they are to a kind of joylessness and in a world of futility, despair. And so the exhortation of Solomon is to remember your creator, but just do it in your youth. And then notice, he actually qualifies here what he means by the term youth in verse 1, and he goes kind of dark on us here, but he says that it's a time before the evil days come and the years draw near when you will say, I have no delight in them. And here's his point. You live long enough and a day's coming where you're going to wake up in the morning and just wonder why it is that you've woken up again. How's that for hope? He just says there's going to be this day that comes, and it's far sooner than any of us would care to acknowledge, but a day is coming where you will literally hate life. And the reason for that is because these are what he calls the Yomei HaRa'ah, the evil days. And the term there, Ra'ah, is used when describing things like evil and misery and injury and even wickedness. And he describes these days as evil because of the reality of what they bring. And he paints that reality for us here, starting in verse 2. Notice he states, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened, and the clouds return after the rain. So this is symbolism. And light and darkness here are these common Old Testament references that actually speak of the failing capacities for joy. And so the returning clouds then here are most likely a reference to the fact that there is an increasing awareness and inevitability of sorrow that comes with old age. And this is the sorrow of old age, verse 3. In the days that the watchmen of the house tremble. This is speaking of your hands, which keep your house being your body. They're what you use to wash yourself, to clothe yourself, to do work in this life. And so as old age comes, they begin to tremble. And so all of those tasks that were once so easy and that you found delight in, or perhaps just took for granted, become increasingly difficult because your keepers can no longer adequately keep. And so his point is this: live long enough and a day is coming for which you will need someone to keep your house for you. Next, he says, and the mighty men stoop. This is a reference to the legs, which become bent and feeble. The strong men upon which you were always able to walk and run and carry your house, to stick with the imagery, have become weak and tired in their old age, and in some cases have just altogether given out. Or the grinding ones stand idle because they are few. This is your teeth. And those who look through the window grow dim. This is your eyes and your ability to see. Verse 4, and the doors on the street are shut. This one's a bit more difficult, but most agree that it's probably talking about that when you lose your teeth, there's just this thing that happens where your lips begin to curl over and your jaw sticks out. Now, we live in a day of the denture, but I remember being in Serbia where such commodities do not exist. And so we were just sort of walking through some of the peasant villages far out from the city, and I'm looking at these older men and women, and this verse immediately pops into my head. It's that sort of pursed look, that look where everything begins to squish and gravity just starts to have its way. This is also right around the time when a person looks as if the soul is beginning to leave the body, and you see this just walking through a nursing home. You look at a person and it looks as if the lights are starting to go out of their eyes, that youthful vitality begins to diminish from their face, and so life appears to be extinguished. And as the sound of the grinding mill is low, this is just talking about the fact that when you have no teeth, there is no chewing, there's no grinding, so you just have to sort of settle for soft foods. And one will arise at the sound of a burr. This is a reference to the fact that the older you get, the more rare that a full night's sleep becomes. You will go to bed early, you will wake up early, and you're going to wake up several times in between. You will have an active bladder. Your body and joints are going to ache. You will wake up to the sound of a bird chirping outside of your window, and so your sleep will be restless at best. And then he says, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. This is a reference to the hearing. With the coming of old age usually comes the loss of hearing. Verse 5, furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and of terrors on the road. This is just a reference to the fact that the older you get, the faster that the world seems to become, and it's accompanied by an incredible fear. And so for those of you who are maybe a bit older in this room, do you ever wonder why it is that this world can't just go back to the way that it was and slow down? The reality, according to Solomon, is that this world isn't becoming faster. You're just becoming slower. And the almond tree blossoms. So when the almond tree blossoms, it actually blossoms with this beautiful white flower. And so contrasted back with the darkness or that statement on the prime of life in verse 10 of chapter 11, this is a reference to the hair. And I like what one man said about this. He said, in some people's cases, when the flower blossoms, it just blows away in the wind. You go bald. And the grasshopper drags himself along. This is just talking about the fact that the older you become, the slower you move. And so you begin to discover that every little task is this incredible chore at best. And the caperberry is ineffective. This is just a reference to the appetite or perhaps sexual vitality. And then look at what he says. For man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street. This needs almost no exposition. For man will go to his eternal home. The conclusion of old age is always death. And so the mourners going about in the street here is simply speaking of a funeral. And here's the thing. The more that you resonate here with all of these things that Solomon has just depicted them and know them and perhaps feel them to be true for you, the closer you are to this conclusion of men going to their eternal home while mourners go about in the street. And so if you don't resonate at all with these things, chances are you're probably a younger person in this room this morning. But look at what he does. Lest you be a fool and assume that youth is somehow a guarantee of old age, he paints a picture of the unnatural death as also a reality. And so everything he just said here describes natural death and the aging process that leads to a natural death. But he also describes the unnatural death as also a reality. So think of a car accident or a war or a tsunami, really any freak accident or calamity that might cause an unnatural death. That's what he's depicting here. So verse 6, remember him before the silver cord is broken, probably speaking here of your spinal column. Or the golden bowl is crushed, that's your head. Or the pitcher by the well is shattered. This is talking about your heart. If the pitcher is shattered or pierced through, the blood will simply flow out and not be pumped to where it needs to go. And finally, the wheel at the cistern is crushed. This is a reference to your circulation and blood flow. And then he says, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to the God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Life is over. And so picking up on his words from chapter 3, from the dust you came and to the dust you shall return, the reality for Solomon is that you are a finite creature. And so no matter how much you resist, the reality is that you have an end. And when that day comes, your soul is going to return to its maker, the one whom you are to remember. And so here's what I think he's saying with this. As long as you have life, whether you're young or old, this is the moment in life, wherever it is that you might find yourself, this right now is the moment in life and time to press in and remember your Creator. Because a day is coming in which the scriptures declare that you will not need to remember him or live with reference to him, because a day is coming in which you're going to see him face to face, but the problem is it's going to be in the judgment. And so it'll be in that moment in which you will give an account of your remembrance of him as you enjoyed or perhaps just presumed upon his good gift of life. As if your life is actually somehow yours. And so for the very last time in Ecclesiastes, we read, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And here's his point. A life that is lived without ever knowing why, or without ever having reference to and for the Creator, is nothing more than an absolutely wasted existence. Because the soul, which is on loan to you as the creature, is going to be required back to its maker, and it will have come back void. And this is why the person of Christ is so incredibly important. If you don't have Christ, quite simply, it does not matter what you do in life. You could spend your days on a park bench. You could be the one who finds cancer, cures cancer. But in the end, no matter what you do or what you've accomplished, it just does not matter. Everything you do is fleeting. Everything you've accomplished will pass. All of it in the grand scheme of eternity, as we saw way back in chapter 1, is of zero significance. The reality of your life and mine is that all it takes, no matter how great you were, is just one generation for no one to know, no one to care, no one to ever remember your name. And so maybe I'll just conclude this section by asking, especially if you're a believer, so what are you living for? What drives you? What motivates you? What are the things that capture the bulk of your thoughts and dreams and perhaps keeps you up at night or gets you up in the morning? What are you living for? Are you only living with reference to the fleeting pleasures of now? Or are you a person driven and controlled in every aspect of your life with reference to your Creator, who has eternally purchased your soul at an enormous cost to himself in the death of his Son? So why do you do what you do? Why do you make the decisions that you make? Why are you perhaps playing fast and loose with the years and the hours and the minute that God has allotted to you for his purposes? So what are you living for? It should be a question that haunts you, especially in light of what he's about to say. And so here's where he kind of shifts topics to conclude the book. And in fact, it's so abrupt that many scholars actually think this ending here, verses 9 through 14, was added later, perhaps even by an editor who wasn't Solomon. But whether it was or wasn't doesn't really matter, because it's the final product of the text that is inspired. And so he just says in verse 9, in addition to being a wise man, the preacher, that is Solomon, also taught the people knowledge. And he pondered and searched out and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. For the words of wise men are like goads, and the masters of these collections are like well-driven nails, for they are given by one shepherd. And he's simply saying, learn to love and heed and pursue wisdom. For it profits much. The entire book of Ecclesiastes has just been one extended piece of divine wisdom. And so this final term here for shepherd is simply a reference to the fact that all that Solomon has said, whether it be his proverbs or his sayings or maybe even somebody else, is that he's just taken and used. But in the end, the point is that it's all been given by one master, one Lord, one God, and one shepherd. And so this is actually nothing less than Solomon's self-stated confession that this is a book of divine inspiration and can therefore be trusted. For Solomon knows better than anybody else that true wisdom, which is found only in the scriptures, is a kind of reality and wisdom that comes from God and God alone. And so he just says in verse 12, you can be a person who keeps chasing. You can keep searching, you can keep running, you can keep groping after the voice and desires of this age, hoping that someday you'll finally discover the calm to your restless soul. But when all is said and done, there is only one true, genuine shepherd, and a shepherd always acts for the good and for the benefit of his sheep. And he has spoken. You and I know that there are so many competing voices, don't we? There are so many promises, so many lies, and yet all they produce in the heart of a man or woman constantly is nothing less than a weary soul. And so Solomon's just saying here, there is a way in which you can actually stop your running. You can actually stop searching. You can stop trying to be the diviner of true wisdom and simply learn to trust and rest in that which is truly good and truly right and perfect, which at the end of the day is simply the inerrant word of the scriptures. And so Solomon just warns here, there aren't many things in this world which you and I can trust, which is what it means by books, but the word of God, because it contains the very wisdom of God, is that one thing in all of the universe that'll actually give you truth and hope and rest that'll sustain you. And finally, in verses 13 and 14, he states the conclusion when all has been heard. And this is not only the conclusion of this chapter or section, but actually the entire book of Ecclesiastes. And so he has spent chapters rehearsing why nothing ever satisfies. If you remember, he was the wealthiest man of his time, 700 wives and 300 concubines. The temple for which he commanded and oversaw 183,300 men and a house so large and intricate it took him 13 years to build. He threw parties which lasted for literally weeks, for which he had to slaughter hills of cattle just to feed his guests. That's an enormous party. He pursued things like drunkenness and pleasure and sex until he had his fill. And his great conclusion when all is said and done is vanity of vanities, all is vanity. These things satisfied for a season, but ultimately failed. They satisfied him for a season, but they ultimately failed. So here's where he gives the greater conclusion. He simply says, fear God. Why? Well, Solomon was a man who spent a lifetime pursuing other idols just to discover they all make really poor gods, didn't he? And so his point all throughout Ecclesiastes has been that as long as you keep lifting up creation or some kind of pursuit in the place of the Creator, it will always fail you. You are putting an impossible expectation on things. And so he just says, fear God. But then he says, and keep his commandments. And so do you want to know if you have a proper reverence and fear for God? Do you want to know if you're perhaps lifting up an idol in the place of God? Then all you have to do is just ask yourself one simple question. Are you keeping his commands. And he doesn't mean just once or twice, but are you in the consistent state of keeping his commands? Because keeping his commands is the natural result and even overflow of love and fear of him. And obedience is not what makes you right with God, but it is what pleases him, having already been made right through the obedience of Christ. And then he says, notice, for this applies to every person, or probably the whole of a person, perhaps picking up on the idea of loving the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And so his point is that no matter who you are or where you live or even when you live, there is none who are or part of anyone that is exempt. For God, as he says, will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. This ought to be an absolutely terrifying notion to us. All things will be uncovered. How many of us still play so fast and loose when we know that nobody else is watching with those secret sins of the heart, presuming upon the grace of God? Presuming that he's somehow okay with it, presuming that tomorrow's the day that you're going to deal with it and set things in order before a holy and righteous God. His point is simply this: learn to live out your life with the great expectation that you will face him. Nothing will go unseen because he judges in perfect justice. And what you need to know about that is that he judges with the fullness of knowledge. Nothing is hidden. So what's Solomon's message for us in light of that? Well, if you take nothing else away from this entire series through the book of Ecclesiastes, I would say take this. Because we will be judged for both good and evil, or for the reward and loss thereof, or if you're not a believer, condemnation. And because God is infinite and therefore the only one that can fill the eternality that has been placed on your heart, remember him. Remember him in your youth. Remember him, or as you perhaps sit in your classes, maybe bored out of your mind in that moment, what does remembering him look like? Remember him in your first year of college, where if you were like me, perhaps it'll sort of be your intellectual awakening. And so because you've taken things like microeconomics or philosophy 101, you think you're the smartest person in the world, and then you can now solve all of the world's problems over a cup of coffee with a friend. In that season, remember him. In your first years of marriage, when you have no money and you're just trying to figure out what it means to be a godly man or woman in the confines of marriage, where your desire is to exalt Christ in your decisions and dealings, remember him. When you're middle-aged and in the absolute monotony of your career and home life, and you're still trying to find ways to feel young or perhaps just change some things up to try and fulfill some of those dreams which just probably aren't going to come, remember him. When you're retired and still living, to quote chapter 1, in monotony, but maybe just in a different way, but when you're watching your children who are now watching their children and you now fall to the background where you're no longer the center of your family and home life, remember him. Remember him and rejoice. For he is God, not only the giver of all good things, but he himself is the ultimate good thing. Life is incredibly short. Your days are fleeting, your hours are passing, but in the final analysis of both life and death, the only thing that will ever matter is a life that's been spent and lived and rejoiced in on this side of the cross, in the person and the work of Jesus Christ. So remember him. Let your life reflect him. and rejoice.